Yes, hello, folks. As promised, the first in a series of interviews with various different United fans to tell the stories of various different United fans' fascinating backgrounds on this podcast. I'm delighted to have my first guest on that series is Pete Boyle. We've got some other exciting guests coming up. We've got Andy Mitten coming up next. So I'm delighted to have Pete on first. For the one person in the world amongst United fan base who doesn't know who Pete is, of course, Pete has been instrumental in writing a lot of the United songs that you hear on the terraces that I've been teaching my kids. He's now retired from that duty, but has made an enormous contribution to United Songbook, which in many ways differentiates him from lots of other football clubs. And you often hear this in the away support where United fans get enormous credit. First of all, how you doing, Pete?
I'm all right, thanks, Phil. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to this.
Absolute pleasure, mate. And let me say, before we get into this, how inspiring it is to see your pictures on Twitter every single day, getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm getting ready to go to bed here in California. And you're out running every single day, more or less. And you look absolutely incredible, mate. Middle-aged men, we need to lift each other up, we need to inspire each other, and I think it's fantastic.
Thank you very much. And it's nice sometimes when I have had random people on Twitter saying, you know, I never did any exercise for years, and you've shaped me into it. And it's a good thing that, you know, if I've inspired one person, it's brilliant. And there's a few people on there who inspire me as well, so they know who they are.
Well, mate, that's the thing. We all lift each other up, you know, instead of turning each other down. And things like that, you know, that transcend all our lives, football teams, football allegiances, to see someone that's like you being able to get up and being able to shift a bit of weight, and just for the mental dividend too, I think it's absolutely brilliant. Especially a lot of people during COVID got really, really depressed, and you know, I'm one of them. But you, like I said, also helped inspire me, because it's really important to see people like yourself, similar age, similar, you know, physical condition, that show you it can be done. So congratulations, mate.
I'll just say to anyone out there who thinks that I don't like running, I hated running before COVID. I've done it before, used to prefer the gym. But the way I see it now is, no matter how busy you are with childcare, with work, I work shifts, bad hours, whatever you're going to, if you're going on holiday, you're going away, you can do 30, 40 minutes a day out of 24 hours. It's a podcast, it's an album, it's a TV show. You can do it. That's what I do.
You know, people are touching on this, but one of the things that also that leads into is it leads to other good habits. When I started doing that, I started eating better, I started sleeping better, and you know, it's all cumulative. The aggregate is that you end up living much better.
Yeah, and I suppose it all links up to really, to, you know, to an age thing, and back onto the podcast of the football life. And yeah, clean my life up. And, you know, I used to, you know, go to every home and away game, and with a large intake of beer. And, you know, and it was good fun for years. It gets to a stage where you think, well, you know, after a bit, like, you know, it's all samey, you don't really appreciate, you know. It's nice when people go out, I see my friends go out and they're having a bottle of wine, or, you know, they're having a couple of pints every few weeks, and they seem to enjoy it. And I think that's when it becomes enjoyable at our age. I think when people are just like, for the sake of it, going, oh, I'll have a drink. And I'm not going to judge anyone if that's what they want to do. But I get to the stage where, you know what, it's nice. And I might become a bit boring now, reading the Kindle on the way to away games. And I mean, I enjoy it. You know, I mean, I go to games with Georgie or Belly, you know, and if we go to an away game, I just like relaxing, really. You know what I mean? It's just nice. I still enjoy myself.
I'm a CMP. You know, I have, instead of, you know, getting lathered, you know, a bottle of wine, bottle of red, bottle of white, you know, with dinner, and sometimes that leads to two. But I enjoy being able to get up in the morning and not feeling like a train hit me, and being able to do things with my kids and all that there. Because, and like you, you know, I spend a lot of time listening to philosophy podcasts, you know, different educational stuff. It just puts me in a really healthy headspace. So, fantastic stuff, mate. Here to talk to you about Manchester United, of course. Peter, I've been familiar with you for a long time before I got to know you personally. Well, first time I was at Old Trafford was 91, and was a subscriber to Red Issue for years. Obviously, you had a section in Red Issue and everybody knows the enormous contribution you've made to United Song. But tell me how you became a Manchester United fan.
Well, it's quite a funny one, really, because you know, I like to think, you know, I'm close to my children, and you know, I think their influence is that, you know, they support United because of me, and it's basically my dad. My dad was an orphan brought up by Catholic nuns, which made me become such an atheist, by the way. Brought up by Catholic nuns after the war, and when he was in the orphanage one day just after the war, and they were picking football teams like we all did in each generation at school, you know. And it was basically, you know, pick teams, and he says, "You're United, you're City." And just by luck, you know, a flick of a coin, they picked the teams anyway. And he said, "Right, heads, you're United, tails, you're City," or vice versa. And my dad was on United's team, and he was a young kid, so he just stuck with United in his head. So bizarrely, I could have been a City fan for the toss of a coin. It's that straightforward. And when people say, you know, I know people who say the dad was a City fan or that Liverpool fan and they're United or vice versa. And I don't like to judge it, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know. If my dad would have been a Stockport fan or would have supported, you know, Port Vale, I would have supported Port Vale. I would have done that. It's just that he took me to United. It was my local team. And I'm very lucky, really. So that's why my dad got a love of United and started going. And he refereed a lot as well. And because of my dad, and, you know, it was good because we were local, but we could just go. He could just take me to games.
It's amazing how these serendipitous moments happen. You know, my mine sort of something similar. You know, my two brothers were Liverpool fanatics. The guy across the street bought me a United kit. Well, I was probably five, I think it was. And ever since then, there was also a glamour about United that was something different, that spoke to me in a way that other football clubs didn't. They weren't the best team in the 80s, but there was something about United, a magic, a mystique, that captivated me as a child. And there was, you know, as well, every time I watched United, they had this flair about them. Yes, they didn't always win, but for me, Pete, I fell and fell hard. I mean, did you feel that similar, you know, where it captivated you, that had a magic?
Yeah, I mean, also, it was like, it was going to games, and days there was people wore colours and they had denim jackets with patches on. And I'm being very young, being in the 70s, you know, my first game was 1974, but I was only four. But when I first started really falling in love with United, it was the Tommy Docherty 76, 77. And I managed to go to quite a few games that season, including, like, you know, most of the cup run, including the semi-final at Hillsborough, including Wembley against Liverpool. And I just remember, like, my dad used to sometimes point me towards the pitch. I was watching all that, probably where my obsession with songs came from. I was watching the array of red, white and black scarves and chanting. And I was mesmerised by it. I was really mesmerised by the singing. And then I also remember how I took it as granted. I thought all clubs had support like ours at the time. And they didn't. I mean, a lot of Liverpool's cosmopolitan support, really, they had fans like maybe in England, but they didn't have as much cosmopolitan support as United until probably the 80s. And in the 70s, believe it or not, as you come on Warwick Road, where Matt Busby Way is now, or where the foundation is, there used to be a stall there. And you won't believe this now when you think about all the ABUs in the 90s, last 20, 25, 30 years. You used to sell tin badges with "I'm an Irish red, I'm a Cockney red, I'm a Yorkshire red, I'm a Brummie red." And I asked my dad once, "Can I have a badge with 'I'm a Cockney red'?" He goes, "No." "What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, you're not, you're from Manchester." And it was no, there was no stigma involved. Yeah. It was proud, right? And 1978, 100 years since the club was formed as such, centenary game against Real Madrid at Old Trafford. And it was free entry, but you had to get a ticket in advance, I think. And about 50,000 at Old Trafford. And I went with my dad, and United won 4-0, so clearly Real Madrid weren't very good at the time. But what I remember, and there's a few pictures gone on social media about it, what I remember before the game was they had a procession, like a march, around the side of the pitch of all the representatives from all the supporters clubs around England and the world, you know. And these people, it was like a political march. It was these people with, you know, Southampton Reds and, you know, New York Reds or whatever, you know, Malta Reds, all marching around the pitch. Some had better banners than others. Some made more effort. But this was like Man United, my club from down the road. So when anyone ever calls United fans, when I was growing, I'd meet someone on holiday and they go, "Oh, where are you from? Man United?" Especially in the 90s and the early 90s. "Oh, we might be team of United." So, "Oh, Man United, at least you're from Manchester." So I challenge everyone. I say, "You support, mate?" And they say, "Arsenal, where are you from?" And they say, yeah, I'm from Southend. I said, why support Southend? Or someone else would say, I'm from Staffordshire. And I said, you know, and I challenged everyone. I said, why do you support them? Because to me, there was never an issue where people came from.
Yeah.
When we weren't very good, we had the highest crowds for Fitch all those years of my growing up, right? It was only an issue when we became successful. Oh, yeah, glory on this list. Now look at every club gets people jumping on the bandwagon. Any club who gets success, we've always had a hardcore support, right? I remember like teams like Stoke. I've got no dislike of Stoke, but they were getting like 10,000 in the Championship like 25 years ago, and then they went up to like 30,000, and they call us glory on us.
Yeah. Come on. I mean, inevitably you get, you know, I'm sure there are people that attaching themselves to it. There's difference between supporting a club and supporting the team. And we see this often played out on social media, where we'll get to that a bit later. I mean, me personally, I had an enormous affiliation with Manchester. My cousins were from Manchester. My cousins still own two nightclubs in Manchester. They own 42s in the venue. And, you know, so I was over there a lot. And as a city that I had enormous affiliation. And one thing I will say about United's fan culture that was unique. You know, I'm a kid growing up in Belfast at the time. Troubles are raging. I'm coming over to Manchester and I'm not sure what to expect. And I have to say, Pete, in all the times that I was coming over there during that time, I never experienced any issue whatsoever. There are certain things that certain support bases have that you would identify with. I don't want to single anyone out, but, you know, there are certain support bases that are far right and all this. United fans never had that culture.
I remember during the troubles in Ireland when I was about, you know, when I was in my teens, I can vividly remember once there was a bit of like, you know, there was rioting in Belfast between, you know, both factions. And while you'd get the two obvious Scottish clubs on one on either side.
Yes.
With United, you'd get United shirts on both sides, which was unique. Mm. And in a similar way, you know, with the horrible events that are happening in the Middle East at the moment.
Yes.
I remember a few years ago, a friend of a friend there was, he's a friend of his, she was making a documentary with the famous newscaster Trevor MacDonald and that over there. And they were doing this thing in the Middle East. And this is going back about early 2000, so over 20 years ago. And obviously it's still going on there. And they were interviewing a Palestinian who was going to give his life for the cause in his like place in Gaza. And he had a very basic, rundown place in Gaza, but it had United posters on the wall. And during the same film they were making, I'd never seen the film, but they were telling me that he interviewed an Israeli soldier, and he was a United fan.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that was just like, shows the contrast of, you know, of Man United. And I also remember doing a BBC World Service documentary a few years ago, and they wanted to interview a contrast of United fans of different backgrounds. And he interviewed a Scandinavian fan and an older fan. He interviewed me from Manchester. He interviewed some guy, I think it was from the Congo. And he'd never seen United play. And he knew when the games were on, how he fell over United. But he used to walk about 8 to 10 miles when United were playing through these villages in Africa, somewhere like West Africa somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
To this village who had a radio, just listen to the game, and he'd sit there. Now, to me, that was dedication. Yeah. That was a proper fan. You know what I mean? That to me is... I used to sometimes whinge at getting stuck in traffic, travelling back to Sale after the game. And I see the coaches from Swansea, my mate runs the branch in the early 70s, and I see the Cockney Reds. And I, you know, you're not ever going to call genuine fans to me, wherever they come from. Some of my best friends don't come from Manchester. Most of my mates have always been United. But to me, I'm proud of our long-standing, you know, and cosmopolitan support, and long may it continue.
Well, Pete, every game for fans across the world is an away game, right? So, you know, the effort that has been made, you know, is very real. I mean, look, one of the things about the magic of Manchester United is it was one of the few things in the world that could transcend, you know, cultural divides, religious divides, sectarianism, wars. United didn't belong to any one particular identity. It didn't matter if we were black, white, brown. It didn't matter where you were from. It didn't matter what your identity was. What you were welcomed. You were part of the United diaspora. And we went, when we would go and support United, and this is this weird contrast I remember the Carrickduff United Supporters Club. We were going over to watch Arsenal. It was a 1-8 game where Rocastle Chip Schmeichel had the off a bar him in the head. Bruce equalised. And that bus was filled with people who, in any other capacity, would have been battering each other. But we were all United fans. Other identities dissolved. And we had this common ground, this unified thing that was Manchester United. And for a lot of people in trouble situations, United, and you would hear even Matt Busby talk about this, United were this opportunity just to forget about everything else was going on outside of your life, what was going on outside your window, and took me to this magical place. The first time I ever cried with joy in my life was when Whiteside scored in 85. I'd never experienced that before. I was 8 years of age. And so it very few things in my life have been able to do that. Manchester United have been one of those. And as a result, it has allowed me to develop relationships and friendships with people who I otherwise wouldn't have, because Manchester United were this unifying force.
Well, that's right. And it's good. I mean, people have often pointed out in 1978 when the famous West Brom game at Old Trafford when they beat us 5-3, and Gerald Sinstad, the commentator, rightly pointed out, sadly, a small section of Old Trafford racist booing, and that sadly was terrible. There's no way you can not condemn it. It was a reflection of society at the time, which is probably also sadly a way it is now. I'm not saying we've got a racist. It's just a reflection of society. After that event, United were the biggest club to have no, what I would say, racist problem. Yeah, you're always going to have, a selection of society. But where right wing sellers would go to Chelsea, West Ham, Millwall, and even Man City, believe it or not, they weren't welcome at clubs in the North East, they weren't welcome at Old Trafford. And it made me quite proud of that for a long time, And maybe that's why. There's some United fans, there's a fair few United fans who do follow England. I've got a few mates who do. But as a general rule, I've never warmed to following any country. It's not because I don't support Ireland or Wales or Scotland or Northern. I just follow United. And I don't really like them. I still prefer the cult element of it's just Man United. Yeah, if England win, fair play if they want it. But I don't get the enjoyment from it. And it's also mixing, I'm going to Germany for a few days with George because he wants to see maybe a game in the Euros. And I'm taking it for him because he loves football. And he knows that I'm not comfortable with going, really. And the last thing I want to do is be in a town centre when people from my country are abusing locals and singing songs about a conflict from the 1940s. You know what I mean? And it's just that side of it, really. It's one of the reasons I never really been into international football.
Yeah, it's similar for me, Pete. I'm not nationalistic at all. I'm someone that happens to be Irish, but I don't sit there and fly flags and think I'm any different or any better than anybody else. I'm just a citizen of the world. I happen to be born here, and I've moved away. One of the things about living out here is it's very culturally diverse. And so you get to meet people from all over the world. That enriches you. And for me, I don't like nationalism at all. I think that anything that promotes prejudice or superiority over someone else is just. I mean, I understand there's people that are okay with that. For me personally, I'm deeply uncomfortable with that.
I'm uncomfortable with it because in one respect, I'd say there's nothing wrong with being proud of where you come from. I'm not saying that everyone who's patriotic is dodgy. But from my own experience in life, and I've been on the planet over 50 years, is that if you scratch beneath the surface, and I don't just mean English people, I mean anyone, someone who's proud to be from Brazil, if you scratch really deep, they don't like Argentinians.
Yeah, I know.
And if you scratch between English, it's Scottish and Scottish. And I think that like you said, we're citizens of the world, aren't we? Know what I mean? And that's what I just think, I just think, if you want to just be proud where you come from, okay, I'm not saying that, but to me, I don't celebrate any English day or Irish day or Welsh day. That's what I live a life and let's all get on. It doesn't mean I don't call out bad behaviour by whoever it is. I don't love everyone. I just want to just give it. I just want to just like living, enjoy my life for whoever it's with.
100%. That's exactly the way I feel, Pete. Let's evolve a conversation on to your support of Manchester United. You end up, I don't know if this was intentional or not, but becoming someone that is iconic in, of course, the evolution of Manchester United's songbook. There's, lots of videos of you on top of tables, being a conductor of, thousands of United fans. How did that all come about?
Well, when I was about 8 years old, I realised I could write verses, poems, and I think that if someone gave me music, I could put lyrics to it. But because I don't write music, a lot of the time, I'll just do it to traditional songs or hymns or whatever, pop songs. Mm. And I just had a poem published in the Manchester Evening News when I was about 8 years old. I still remember it, that's short. I'm football crazy and football mad. I support Man United. I go to watch them with my dad. I like Old Trafford, Main Road 2, Goodison Park and Anfield. Don't you? And that was my meaning paper. And then when I was 15, I was writing more verses and had a poem published in the same paper, the Manchester Evening News, about the 1985 Cup final, all about the whole game. And I've actually once, I remember doing it to Norman once, we was in the pub toilets before we knew each other. And I think he thought, oh God. And I'm going, Whiteshead curled to deafening roar. And he's like, I'm trying to do his zip up, you know. And then about 10 years ago, I was working at the airport in one of my other jobs. And Ron Atkinson comes through, just going through, I was getting a flight through duty free. And I goes over to him and went, a Worthy Cup final it proved to be. And he's like, what? And then since then, we've met each other and he's all right. He still thinks I'm a nutter. So I started doing things like that. And then in the early 90s, I realised I could hold a thing in it. And what I decided was, we had a lot of songs at the time about the 70s and 60s and early 70s. And we didn't really have any songs, apart from a couple of chants for Norman. We didn't have any real classic songs in the 80s and mid 90s. And I felt like I wouldn't even say there was a market there because nobody really did it. And in those days, you couldn't just do it in your bedroom like this on a Zoom. You couldn't do it. You had to go to a studio. And we've had Chas and Dave, and you could even argue you'd had New Order of England, but there'd been no real football songs recorded on albums with no effing and jeffing, with just as uncensored, right?
United fans at one point sung You'll Never Walk Alone, Pete, didn't they?
Yeah, they did, yeah. I mean, it was sung, I think it was sung until about, I think the last time I remember it.
Belonged to everybody.
Yeah, well, it was a generic song. Chelsea sung it. Most people would acknowledge we sang You'll Never Walk Again, but it wasn't Liverpool's anthem solely until it was probably, we sang it at the 83 Cup Final replay. That was probably the last time. And I remember we played Liverpool maybe the following season. I think it was a night game. I think Craig Johnson scored, but I'll have to ask Thomas from Norway who scored that goal and tell me. But I think we got beat and they sung it that night, the Liverpool fans, and the whole stretch for them whistled it down. And in my eyes, that's when we started whistling it down. Mm. It was still a generic song then. And then in 1992, Liverpool tried to trade the badge in because they wanted to copyright it, like United with taking the crest off, football club off. And Liverpool put You'll Never Walk Alone on the badge. But it wasn't, and on the gate, but it wasn't solely Liverpool's song, yeah, at the time. But yeah, but going back to the, I realised that there'd been albums like there'd been Chas and Dave, there'd been Tottenham songs, and there'd been football songs, but there'd never really been a fan going in the studio and just doing songs. So I started making songs up in the bath at the time, hence the title, Songs from the Bathtub. And I just kept getting more and more chants, and I started thinking, right, and I was getting ideas, and I just said, I printed out this little typed out sheet, Songs from the Bathtub, and then I decided I'm going to record an album. I'd never done it before. So I rang around from Yellow Pages, these different studios, and they're very expensive. And I found one, and he said, right, the cheapest I could get it was like Tuesday night, 11 o'clock at night, till 4 in the morning. So we went there with a load of cans from the supermarket. And I rang around to about 7 or 8 lads who's coming to do it. They went, yeah, all right, night out, young lads, no commitments. And we did it in this studio in Manchester. And it turned out the studio where Smith's recorded some early stuff. Do you remember that Oceanic song, Take Me Into Insanity? Mm-hmm. That was recorded there. 808 State recorded there. We're not missing out. And we recorded it. And the guy from the Pebble of the Peak on the accordion, and he was really drunk. So we had to send him home halfway through. So on the cassette, Side one, Songs in the Bathtub. Side one's got music. Side two hasn't. No one really picks up on that because we just put it in order. And it was also a few days, about a week before we recorded it, was my first, not the first time I'd met Eric, but the first time I'd met him properly, like not away from the club. And what it was, I'd gone to rehearse in the Pebble at the Peak in Manchester, and we were upstairs in the flat. It was a Tuesday night, and Manchester wasn't like it is now. It wasn't busy every night. It was quiet Tuesday night. And Nancy, God bless her, she came upstairs and said, "Boys, there's somebody downstairs you might want to see in the pub." We went, "Yeah, right." So we comes downstairs into the vault of the Pebble of the Peak pub, and I've got this document in my hand, Pete Boyle's Songs in the Bathtub, and Eric's playing table football in the pub. Eric's playing table football with this guy's mate and Claude Bolly, which is Basil Bolly's brother, you know, the former player. Yeah. The guy behind the bar, Danny, he's never seen me go quiet. Nobody sees me go quiet. And I'm like this. And he goes like that. So he pours the drink and he goes to Eric, "That guy writes songs about you." And Eric goes, "On the table." "Yeah." I went, "Yeah, yeah." And can I have a look? And I gives him this thing. And I'm like, that's that there. And that's really, although I'd met him in Budapest the year before, that's how the friendship sort of started. And to get the guy there with him there, Claude Bolly, he brought a book out maybe about a year ago about Eric being with Eric all around. Came out maybe about, it was out last Christmas, maybe it was out a year ago. And we keep in touch loosely, yeah. And that was that. That was just surreal stuff. But the point was, when the guy in the studio heard it, there was coughing on it. We were out of tune. We were missing the music. And he goes, "Do you want to redo it?" I went, "No, that's perfect." And everyone's going, "How can?" Because I knew what I wanted to do. And I went around telling him. And I think Jim White, obviously the journalist, the one who writes with Andy Mitten and that. I think he did it in. He reviewed it in his book. And he was reviewed in the paper once, and he said, he saw me outside Wembley, a mop of black hair, he said, selling this tape. He goes, "I bought one, I got it home, played it. It was foul-mouthed, out of tune, full of juvenile spleen, badly timed," because I loved it. You know, he built it up with all these, like, what would normally be in a music magazine would normally be like ripping it apart. But his last line was, "I loved it." You know what I mean? Yeah. And that became a bit of a cult classic, as you probably know. And I remember, like, the late, great Terry Hall, about 20 years ago, these pop stars from, like, Spice Girls and all around, from Mike Skinner, from the Streets, and a load of pop stars had to pick the top 10 albums of all time. And, you know, and Terry Hall's top 10 was something like David Essex, David Bowie, and number seven was Pete Wales' Songs from the Bathtub. And it was like, whoa, you know what I mean?
Pete, there are many things that I'm envious of people of. And I've been lucky enough over the years doing this to have interviewed some amazing football players. But your relationship with Eric Cantona is one where I am envious of. I think when I was a child, Mark Hughes was someone I absolutely idolized. And I don't think people of today understand how transformative Cantona was. And the, you know, what 1992 UK was like, what 1992 United was like. There wasn't the influx of foreign players. Cantona brought this continental flair, completely changed Manchester United. And immediately was exceptional. A player born to play for Manchester United had the aura, had the magic, and I absolutely worshipped him. Just sensational. But not just as a football player, you know, his philosophy, you know, the intrigue of what he is off the field. And here we have even today Jim Ratcliffe, you know, a significant purchase of the football club, naming his holding company, you know, the Trawlers, which, you know, so he captivated the imagination of everyone. Would you say Cantona was probably United's most transformative signing that they made in your lifetime?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can't underestimate Brian Robson's influence. Robert was unbelievable, and I love Roy Keane. I completely love Roy Keane and what he did for United's leadership. He's brilliant captain, But if I'd always pick Robbo over Keane purely. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I think the people who go for Keane, I've got to it now, but the people who go for Keane, I think, which was a bit of a debate on social media a few days ago, I think they're referring to Pete Keane and the team Robbo last couple of years. Robson, we know how good Robson was, but
when you're talking about concerns, they're just you can't go wrong either way.
No, you can't. There's not a wrong answer, but I would generally say younger fans who the people, you know, people under 40 might go for Keane, people over 40 would probably go for Robbo, or I would say, and that seems to be the consensus. But the Eric thing, yeah, I mean, you can't underestimate Dennis Irwin signing, you can't underestimate Schmeichel, right? But you just hit a nail on the head a minute ago. Dennis is one of the best ex-players I've ever known. I'm pleased to know, you know, see him socially sometimes, and we do gigs together. And he's what a wonderful person. But the difference between, say, Eric and that goalkeeper I just mentioned, you know, unbelievable. Because Eric, when he was at the Cliff, he was chat to fans. He loved to stay with fans. Anyone who's had an experience, red or blue, in the city centre back in the day. Even people who didn't like United, then they just went, whoa, Eric. See, Liverpool fans, yeah, they hated him in 96. They hated him, but they respect him. They knew he had something about him. He's just, you know, I remember Eric's friend telling me about, when Eric was still playing for United, he'd be having a meal in Manchester and some rough-looking guy be in a restaurant or a pub and Eric would be there and his wife would come up and say, oh, I love you, Eric, you can have my kids and all that. And he's like, and the bloke would go, all right, mate. You know what I mean? And I think, but what it was with him, he's like, his whole package as a human being, right? You know, he's like, you know, he was into music differently. Let's be honest. Or you might idolize footballers, but if you went through the years, and maybe especially with modern ones, you probably wouldn't have a pipe with some of the modern ones. You wouldn't have much in common with them. Right. You wouldn't have much in common, would you? You know what I mean? Whereas someone like Eric. You would do, yeah. And he'd chat, and you know, I've been lucky to be in his company, and I'm not one of his best mates. No way, I don't never claim that. But I've been in his company, and we've had good laughs. And you know, probably the peak was in Norway because you know we travelled on coach together for 2 hours, and we had in jokes, and we were on a speedboat, and he was driving it. You know, it's just surreal, really. You know, but like I've chatted to him about football, I've chatted to him about music and politics, and we've lots in common like that, you know. And we chatted about music at his last concert we were doing, and it wasn't just like, in some ways, my wife would say to him, my kids would say, but if Eric would have got up and gone like that, I would have gone, yeah, I love it, right? Yeah. I would have done that. If Eric would have sang Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. But the fact is, I generally liked his stuff. I'm not just saying that. We've spoke about like Lou Reed and Nick Cave and you know, Iggy Pop and that in the past. And I found his stuff quite, you know, I don't even understand all the French of it, but some of his stuff was really moody and light and dark, like, and, you know, I love my music. And what I found was interesting was that it wasn't a novelty. Some people went to see him as a novelty because it was Eric when he was doing his concert, right? But he took it really seriously. He had a really good stage show. He came on, he had the presence, he had dressed like a star. And you know what? I know people who went there who were genuinely like, I'm not even saying blew away, but they were quite impressed. And you know, he wrote the songs himself. He got the musicians in. He didn't want to just. It wasn't. I'm just going to sing a load of Christmas songs. I'm going to do a load of cover versions when record companies cash in on a popular person's name. You know, let's sing this, let's sing that. You know, because you're popular, you know, you could get a few. Make a book. Let's do a book. Let's do like it. Eric takes it seriously. When he stopped playing football, he went into acting. People really thought, oh, a bit cynical. But he went in as a bit part player, bit part actors, and he built himself up and he got respected. And then he completely focused on it. And then when he decided he wanted to do music, it was a bit of a shock to me. Mm. But then I thought, well, was it? But he wants to take it seriously. And he's built his way up. Now, he hasn't just, you know, he could have probably got some support or something, but he wants to do his own thing. And we had a chat after the next... Sorry?
I said, I love that. I love that people don't, you know, pigeonhole themselves and realise, you know,
what person could reinvent themselves so much as a really good footballer and then a serious actor and now as a musician? Not everyone might think people might not think he's the new coming. He's not the new, they might not think he's like, you know, the new Jim Morrison and things like that. But in his own way, he's writing unique stuff. And I really enjoyed it. And I'm looking forward to going back in April to see him. And we had a really good chat after the concert about it. And he did two nights in Manchester. And he almost apologised. He almost apologised to me and a couple of people there afterwards. because he thought that he put on a better show the first night. But you know what? That must have been a really good show, because I really enjoyed the second show. And I just think what I'm saying is with him is his football changed everything. But like, you know, you can meet, sometimes they say you don't want to meet your idols, and you know, you always get people on good and bad days. But you know, I remember being at Wembley for the semi-final against Brighton. And we were in the ground about 2 hours early. We had these great seats right next to the where United bench was. And we were just taking it in, me and Georgie. And former goalkeeper, who we've mentioned before, came walking up. And there was nobody around. He had a couple of people walking with him, like young staff who were like the people looking after him, like, you know, not bouncers, like a man and a woman, but they looked about in their 20s. And we said, excuse me, can my son have a quick photograph? And they were going, oh, we're really busy. And there was no one around. He didn't say anything. So I took a picture with Georgie and him. And I wish I'd not done it. Now, Georgie didn't ask for it. I didn't want one. I did it for Georgie. And I looked at the picture again. And it just looks like, it looks like, you know, when there are pictures where people don't want to smile, like they're being forced. I've seen it again at Old Trafford when he's been stood near the tunnel. Young kids have taken a picture. And he's like, I'm not saying that every day, every ex-footballer is going to be smiling on best behaviour, but he's got a bit of form for it. And the difference between that and the genuine warmth, some players know, goes with the territory, right? Players earn a lot of money. Some ex-players might not have earned as much as now, but they've had a good living out of football, right? If they're with the family having a meal, I understand it.
Yes, totally understand
it. It's intrusion, right? If there's a massive crowd out all baying it outside the ground, I understand that. You know, and I just thought that I didn't want a picture. And, you know, even Georgie said, I wish I'd not asked you. I wish you'd not asked. Yeah, I wouldn't ask him again, right? You know what I mean? And that's the difference where... When Eric met Georgie, you know, he asked him about, you know, we were chatting at the art gallery last year when he did the launch of Michael Brown's paintings. And he's interested. He's not just being like, he's not rubbing his head in like a little patronised. He's saying, how are you? And he's talking about his own son playing football. And then he sees Georgie in Manchester at the concert last year. And he's going, oh, Georgie, how is it? What have you been playing? And he's asking about tactics and about United's team.
That's costly.
And he's giving his opinion, and I'm like that because Georgie talks about a game and I do about modern football, you know. And that's the sort of person he is. And I just think that combined with being the footballer he was, and I think, you know, his views on, you know, weren't being political, but I do, you know, we're on the same side, you know, on lots of things. But his views on lots of things, he's, you know, he's for a fairer society. He's always...
Pete. It's just about recognising those human equivalency and not having systemic inequities. I know my privileges are based on someone else's oppression. We're all equal. Like, I don't want to say any of that. That's really, I might not say it right. I may get it wrong sometimes, but what I'm trying to say is that I don't want any privilege given to me or anyone else. It's taken from someone else.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's it. And it doesn't mean, you know, I won't condemn him for making money. You know, he makes money. To me, he makes money, he's doing his thing, he's earning his living, but he still believes in other people being given opportunities. Sure. And I think, like, you know, I just think he's contributed a lot more than just the football to United, but we're very lucky the way he transformed us. And again, back to the start when you said to me, how did you become a United fan? Sometimes life is full of things, whether how you meet your partner, your other half, how I became a United fan, how Eric joined United, if the story, you know, the contrasting stories about how Fergie asked, you know, about Dennis Irwin, they wanted to sign Dennis Irwin from Leeds, and we asked about Eric, and the rest is history. If Leeds wouldn't have sold him to us, if Dion Dublin not got injured, you know, you just don't know. And it's just how it is. And the impact he had on Man United in those, you know, in those 5 years there, you know what I mean? We won the league 4 times and we didn't win it the year he was out, obviously suspended. Like, so I just think the impact he had on the club, he shaped the club. It's well documented by Beckham and Neville's and Scholesy and Butty and all them, how Eric set the tone for the training, staying behind and him giving the mentality. And when he was at United, he was totally professional. You know, he'd go out and have a couple of, like, you know, a couple of waters or Diet Cokes. He was really focused on everything. And everything about him. And I think that you've got to give credit to Fergie as well for the way Fergie handled him. Because I think much he's made that Eric got away with murder.
Yeah.
But if you know what Fergie's like, publicly, Fergie realised you're not going to throw a boot at Eric or dressing down verbally in front of the team, because he would have jumped off, he would have run off, he would have told him where to go.
You'd ultimately tell what you do in a pitch, and Cantona delivered for him. So you make some exceptions for people. I mean, there was exceptions made for George Best, there was exceptions made for players, that if you can deliver on the pitch, then your tolerance for, you know, certain things off the pitch, you know, and appreciate that too.
Well, the thing is, right, in the summer of 95, it looked like, because of all the press intrusion after the Sellers thing, that he was going to leave. You know, he was having enough. His family were being hounded and all. Everywhere he went, he was on holiday at time on the beach, and Terry Lloyd came and hassled him and all that. And he was all going to leave. And I always remember one of the right-wing rags, the Express or the Mail. And I remember running a story why Eric was joining Inter Milan. That was the back page, right? And that was the day when Eric came out with the press comment that he was staying at United. And when you think about it, and I asked Eric about this a couple of times down the years, thinking of seeing now, he was ready to quit England, not because he didn't love United, because, you know, he probably thought England had had enough and it was too much for his family and himself. And
Bert Milicic really went after him. Like, I mean, they wouldn't let him kick a ball. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, but when you think about it, right, Fergie then was already like one of the best managers in Europe, if not the world. And Eric, before you could track people down like you can now with mobile phones as much and all that. And Fergie goes to Paris. Fergie's on the back of a moped or a motorbike, going round different places in Paris, knocking on for finding Eric. So when Eric found that out, that Sir Alex, well, Alex as he was, Alex Ferguson, is come to Paris on the back, and he's on the back of a motorbike, trying to track him down to stay United. And I think it was like a father figure, and I think he knew how. You saw that letter that Fergie wrote to Eric the year after he retired, whatever. And, you know, it's gone public. You can find it out there where he basically says, I think you retired too early, but I respect what you are as a person. And, you know, you're always welcome. And, you know, I wish you'd stayed longer. You could have had a couple more years. But you've got to respect how Eric did it in the end, because we both know that sometimes you might have a favourite player, or you might have a favourite pop star, rock star, whatever. And you wish you'd called it a quits a few years ago, because the best years have gone. And to me, Eric didn't have a bad last season. It's just that the season before was exceptional with him leading us to the double and all that. And I think that by his own standards, he probably thought his own standards had slightly dipped. Not dipped, but slightly not as good. And Eric didn't want to cheat anyone. So Eric thought, I want to quit now. We all know that he could have probably played another 3 or 4 years.
My only regret with him, Pete, is he didn't get to win the European Cup with United.
Yeah, and it's
that.
And we could have done it in 97, really, couldn't we?
No.
But then you don't know how fate would have took you, do you? You don't know whether that would have meant, you know, if we'd done that and then the team dismantled, would we have bought Stan? Would we have got Ollie?
Yeah, I know.
You know,
he was essentially his replacement scores in 99. So, you know, the kind of facts, well, you know, it was real, but yeah, I agree.
But then you could say, you know, I think it's a shame that Whiteside didn't play with Eric and they didn't play in the same team. And you could have, you know, Norman to have got like a title medal like Robbo did. You know, Robbo got two end of his career, but they were thoroughly deserved. And it made it even sweeter that Gerrard didn't get one, actually. You know what I mean?
Most definitely did. Peter, I've got one or two questions that I'm going to let you go because I know it's late. Quick question on Ferguson. How would you describe his legacy? Do you feel his legacy has been tainted by the Glazers? Because we have to be honest, you know, when the Glazers are trying to buy Manchester United, Ferguson is a virulent defender of the Glazers, when clearly it was obvious that they were not in United's best interest. Like any legacy, it's complicated. On the pitch, irrefutable what he did. But do you feel that with the presence of the Glazers, it's tarnished it?
I think to some fans it is. You can't deny that. I mean, to me, having been in his company a lot, you know, it saddens me that the Glazers are there. And, you know, if somebody took over your company and said, you know, I'm the new boss now, would you stand out? Some people might do. I understand completely why people are saddened by it. I mean, because I want the Glazers out for me. I just can't bring myself to sort of like, he's given me so much pleasure for what Fergie's done. And, you know, the guy made most of my life so happy watching United. I've been in his company. He's a beautiful person to me. I'm not going to ever badmouth him. There's lots of things gone wrong. The Glazers are the core issue. It's sad that lots of people maybe haven't come out against them. And, you know, I understand why people are going to criticise the boss for it. Like I said, I'm not going to deny that. I can't say they shouldn't call. You know, they can't call anyone who defended him. Like I said, I just try and separate them. Really, I'm not trying to sit on the fence, but you know, the guy gave most of us our best of our pleasure. It's the fact that the Glazers have done so much damage to Manchester United. I think everyone who's ever given him a pass would wish they probably hadn't done.
It's always difficult when you know the human being also, rather than, you know, rather than just a public figure. You're almost criticising an avatar because you don't know this person personally, so there's no nuance to it. But I can understand why that would be difficult. Last question on Sir Jim Ratcliffe, of course. Enormous changes quickly. Are you optimistic with the future?
Yeah, well, it's a difficult one, really, wasn't it, in terms of the whole thing, because I know some modern social media fans just wanted to, you know, go out, wipe all the debt out. Like, we'd all like to wipe the debt out, and they didn't care who owned us. It's just better, let's be like City and Newcastle, let's buy everyone, let's wipe out the debt. You know, the days of having a local, I know Jim Ratcliffe is local, essentially, but the days of having a local guy, I think for me, still lives in the town, buying your club, it's sort of gone, really. But we opposed takeovers, and, you know, Ratcliffe, at the moment, you know, in the short term, it seems to, you know, with Dave Brailsford in particular, and this new guy who they've got in, it seems to, from across the road, they seem to be quite serious about shaking things up. There's been a lot of people there let's be honest with you, going back to the Glazers and Woodward, there's been no structure there for a long time.
Yeah.
Biggest club in the world run like a corner shop, yeah.
Yeah.
And I've said it lots of times, but like when City got took over, yeah, they won the lottery in lots of ways, but they had a plan. He went out. The people who got from Barcelona didn't know who City were. Yeah. He tripled the wage. He said you can live in London and Barcelona or whatever. And they transformed it. They got a structure. And, you know, when Pellegrini was manager, they knew Pep was coming. They were buying from there. They all set up. They've got everything structured. United were just got Woodward, who was doing business deals 1 minute, making silly boasts he couldn't keep next minute. And really, there was no structure. Buying players, trying to fit them in rather than having a plan, what players we need. And let's be honest, it goes up to back to Ollie. Well, I love Ollie. Ollie, you know, Ollie did better than people give him credit for. Yeah. But Ollie was meant to be a short-term solution. Ollie wanted certain players. He's come out, didn't get them. Ollie didn't buy Ronaldo. Ollie didn't buy Donny van der Beek. That just shows you. Liverpool, Jurgen Klopp. You know, Liverpool had a plan when Rodgers was in his last days. They wanted Klopp. They've had a structure. We've had nothing like that. And now it looks like in the short term, straight away, that they're asking questions. Why has that player got a 6-year contract? Why is he on that much money? What's he doing? And I'm sure they'll be going round and looking at people with laptops and saying, what are they doing? And I think it can only be a good thing. I wasn't that optimistic. Nothing excited me. The two options that were meant to be on the table, nothing excited me. All I knew was it's got to be better than the Glazers. Sure. Whichever way, it's got to be better than the Glazers, having full control at least. I know they're still there. But one thinks that somebody like Jim Ratcliffe made his money. He's not going to want to just like have no say long term. Surely he's got to be getting something out of it. Maybe there's an option to take over within a few years. No, he's not getting any younger. But in the few weeks that they've been involved already, it looks like they mean business. But let's not kid ourselves. The club's in a mess still. It's going to take a while.
Quickly, Ten Hag, is he the right man?
I think he's got a lot of the big decisions right. Mm-hmm. I still want to believe in him. I think his problem, he's pulled a pile on himself. A couple of problems is he overachieved in the first season.
Yep.
He got the expectation levels risen. because you win a trophy, you get to another final. You know, we could have got to the Europa final, really had a better squad slightly as well. We got third in the league, but these players aren't good enough. Most of these players have thrown the last few managers. I still believe in Ten Hag, but you know, each bad defeat, people are getting more and more despondent. Mm-hmm. And every manager's made some bad signings. Fergie, Atkinson, Tommy Doherty, you know, everyone, Busby would have made some back in the day, right? But at the moment, I don't like too great. I love David De Gea for years. It was time to replace him. The jury's out in a big way because it doesn't look like we've upgraded. Also, people like Anthony, you wonder what's going on there. There's a few players. There's a good clear out needed. I think Ten Hag still is the man. And I've said it publicly before. I hope he gets a chance to turn it around. I think he's a good manager. But he's going to have to live and let you know. He's got to stand by the signings now. He's either going to have to make a decision and have the balls to drop big them players he's paid a lot of money for, or he's going to stick by them and they're going to bail him out, or they're going to throw him under.
Let's see what happens. Pete, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. There's a million questions I didn't get to ask you. So maybe I can get you back sometime. Keep doing what you're doing, mate, on social media, doing, inspiring us. And as a community, we all appreciate it. Absolute pleasure, mate. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this, and give my best to Georgie.
Well, thanks very much. Look forward to seeing you. Cheers, mate. Bye. Bye.